As you know, foreclosures are still on the rise, and millions of foreclosed homes are now sitting vacant. At the same time, a growing number of families are homeless. Now, with some of these people having nowhere to go, they're moving into all those empty homes.
The fundamental mission of this generation is to elevate housing to the level of a human right.
Max Rameau is house hunting.
It has to be in good condition, it has to have electricity that can run through, it has to have water that can run through the house.
He's not a buyer or a seller. He's scouting for foreclosed and abandoned homes. Driving through Miami's Liberty City, it only takes him a few minutes to find one.
This is a complete waste. This is not benefiting anyone. It's not benefiting the bank. It's not benefiting the community. It's not benefiting any of the families. There's no reason this house is empty.
You cannot engage in a social clash by having a small number of volunteers in one remote corner of a society take over a relatively small number of homes. It can only happen when the entire society is engaged in a struggle, is engaged in building a vision, is engaged in building a new kind of future.
Max Rameau is the founder of the Miami-based organization Take Back the Land. In 2006, the organization seized control of a vacant lot and built a shanty town called Emoja Village. Take Back the Land then began a campaign of taking over bank-owned foreclosed homes and moving homeless families into them.
Max Rameau just completed a Northwest tour from November 12th through the 17th. We recorded his speech at Portland State University on Friday, November 13th. This is Walita Imarisha.
So I want to welcome everyone to Max Rameau Take Back the Land. It's very exciting to see such a packed house to talk about these really important issues around housing and economics and what we are all going to do about it. My name is Walita Imarisha, and I'm an adjunct instructor with the Black Studies Department. And this event is co-sponsored by the Black Studies Department, the Association of African Students, Students for Unity, the History Department, Sociology Department, KBOO Radio, and Portland Housing Center. And everyone really worked to bring this event together, and we couldn't have done it without all of the co-sponsors.
Tonight on Circle A Radio, we will listen to Max Rameau's speech and hear about the struggle for land and housing in Portland. Stay tuned.
Good evening.
Good evening.
My name is Max Rameau, and I'm with the group called Take Back the Land. I'd like to thank everyone for coming here this evening. And of course, I especially want to thank the organizers of this event, the Black Studies Department, and particularly Walita for putting together this event. It takes a lot of time and effort to do this, and I know a lot of people have better things to do on a Friday night, and so thank you all for coming. So that is for being here tonight, but in a bigger sense, I also want to thank those who made it possible for us in the historic meaning of the term for us to be here. You know, the last time I was in Portland, I found out that in Oregon's constitution, the original constitution, it was illegal for black people to try to move here, to try to live here. And then this morning on a radio show, I found out that the punishment for that is they would capture the black person and subject them to public flogging. So at one point, it would have been illegal for me to come and try to live here. And yet tonight, I'm able to come here and talk about liberating homes. So what's the difference? What happened in between a time where I could have been arrested and flogged for trying to live here, and today we're able to talk about some of the things that we have to talk about today? The difference is that we had people, millions of people, who were willing to struggle, who were willing to sacrifice, who were willing to bleed, and some even died for our right to be here tonight, to be here this evening and do some of the things that we're doing and talk about some of the things that we talk about. So our ability to be here is really based on a movement which preceded us, and people who were engaged in that movement, who didn't even know anyone in this room, who didn't even know me, and made it possible for us to be here tonight. And if the reason we're here is because of the movement that came before us, then we have an obligation back to that movement that made it possible for us to be here. And we have an obligation to participate in the movement and make it possible for those who come after us to be able to do even bigger and better and greater things. The only way that social advancement happens, that advancements for humanity happens in this society, is through mass struggle, is by people getting together, joining organizations, and fighting, struggling for the things that they believe in, struggling to transform the society in a way that they want to see it transform. I think this is true in any time and in any case. I think this is particularly true and particularly meaningful in this time when we're facing a severe economic crisis. The crisis that we are facing is bad. I believe it's only going to get worse. And there are a large number of people and a growing number of people who are suffering and suffering tremendously because of it. And that suffering is happening across class and across race lines. However, to be honest, the truth is the crisis is disproportionately impacting low-income people and disproportionately impacting low-income black women. And we have to be cognizant of that as we talk about the crisis and as we talk about how we solve the crisis and make this world a better place. So when society endures a severe crisis related to housing or related to foreclosures, members of that society suddenly become willing to re-examine their relationships to land, to housing, and to the economic systems that made the crisis happen in the first place. A few years ago, while people were running madly after money so they can buy houses for no money down, throw a coat of paint on them, and then flip them, when people were paying $200,000 for a house that was only worth $100,000 because they thought they were going to be able to sell it 6 months later for $300,000, no one was questioning the economic system. When people were playing the lotto, right before the numbers are read, no one's questioning how bad of a system the lotto is. People only start questioning how bad it is right after they realize they weren't the ones who won. But now, that meant that the housing boom, so-called housing boom, has turned into a bust, and so many people are injured by it. People in this society are questioning the relationship they have to economic systems, the relationship they have to housing, and really what the fundamental meaning of housing is in this society, what's the fundamental function of housing in this society. So the pain and suffering that people are feeling now because of the crisis is compelling people, it's compelling segments of the society to rethink their relationships, and that's creating an opportunity for the social justice movement. The opportunity for the social justice movement is to put together, to project, and to articulate a new vision for what this society could be, the way the society could be organized, and the way the society relates to, people, people to government, people to corporation, and ultimately all those entities towards land and even towards housing. So that means as bad as this crisis is, as many people are going to be harmed because the crisis is forcing people to rethink their relationships to land, rethink their relationships to housing, we have a chance to reshape, we have a chance to transform this society into something which will benefit a much larger number of people, particularly as it deals with land and as it deals with housing. So this idea that when you have a crisis, people rethink their relationships to things, and then that transforms the society, speaks to theories about how history is made, how history advances, how societies are transformed. And this theory of social transformation states that every society has conflicts and have contradictions that causes problems, causes tensions in that society. But some of those conflicts, some of those tensions get so deep and so severe that it rises to the level of a crisis. And not just a crisis in a school, and not just a crisis in a community, but a crisis throughout the society. So it goes from being a minor crisis or a regional crisis or a very controlled crisis to being a major crisis in the society. In response to the crisis, then, different segments of the society develop competing ideas about how to resolve the crisis. So, for example, if there's a crisis in this society where there are large numbers of people who are not able to get health care, then there are all kinds of ideas about how to get people greater access to health care. Some people say you can't allow patients to sue doctors. Some people say that you have to reduce costs. Some people say that the government has to have an insurance plan. And others say that there must be a universal single-payer system that would allow everybody to get covered. But the society then struggles among all these different ideas. The different interests who are advancing any particular idea are engaged in the struggle to say that this idea is the best one. This is how we're going to emerge from this crisis, and this is how we're going to get coverage for more people or get more people protected. This struggle, these competing ideas, is a social clash. So you have a crisis, and as a result of the crisis, you have competing ideas of how to resolve that crisis, and those competing ideas clash with one another, and out of the clash emerges a new society, or at least a new segment of the society, where this clash happens, and then as a result of this clash, things work in a different way after the clash than they did during the clash or before the clash, for better or for worse. The process involves a crisis, a clash after the crisis, and then a new society or a new segment of the society emerges. Social clashes are nothing new. Social clashes happen on all kinds of levels, and they happen in every society. The United States, to date, has gone through three major social clashes which have transformed the society in fundamental ways. The first social clash happened around the Civil War. The crisis around the Civil War time was that there was a new kind of economy developing, which was the Industrial Revolution. And no society, of course, can have two economic systems operating inside of it at the same time. And so there was a clash around, should the society be a slave society, or should the society be one that has an economic system of capital industrialization? Ultimately, the clash rose to the highest level and became a full-out civil war. And what emerged afterwards was a new society, the end of slavery, at least the end of legal slavery, and the emergence of the Industrial Revolution, which changed the history of this country forever. The second major social clash was around the Great Depression. The crisis was you had a complete and total economic meltdown, and the clash was how do you deal with the meltdown, how do you recover from the meltdown? And some of the competing ideas were that businesses should be allowed to do whatever they want to do in order to revive the economy. And others were that we need to create a social safety net so that you don't have millions of people walking around the street looking for housing and doing all kinds of other things. The labor movement was extremely well organized and struggled mightily to win some demands and win some rights. And as a result, the society was fundamentally transformed. Child labor laws came into effect. Children no longer work in coal mines. We had a 40-hour work week, and there was a social safety net built through the New Deal. And all that happened because the society clashed, and something new emerged as a result. The third major social clash happened around the Civil Rights Movement, where you had a growing number of black middle class who said, I can afford to eat in this restaurant, and I'm not allowed to. I can afford to live in this neighborhood, and I'm not allowed to. And a social clash emerged where there had to be a decision about where the society was going to go. Was it going to continue down the road of segregation, or was there going to be legal non-discrimination, even if not integration? Ultimately, millions of people mobilized and organized, faced dogs, faced water hoses, and was able to defeat the legal system of Jim Crow and segregation. And the society changed significantly. And also got the Great Society programs, which enhanced the social safety net. So those were the three major social clashes that the United States has already gone through. As a direct result of the current economic crisis, we believe this society is on the cusp of entering into the fourth major social clash. And this fourth major social clash, because of the nature of the crisis, is going to be fundamentally based on land and land relationships. And the way we're going to see that manifested, of course, is through housing and the housing crisis.
You're listening to a speech by Max Rameau on Circle A Radio.
As millions of people are losing their homes, including large numbers of middle-class people and white people, those who are normally shielded from this kind of brutal economic activity, people are questioning basic preconceived ideas about how the economy should function and how land and housing relationship should exist. And that's creating the basis for these competing ideas, which is going to make up the social clash. So as a direct consequence of both the scope and depth of the crisis, people are reconsidering financial markets, the size of corporations, and of course, land and housing themselves. So at this very moment, banks are reporting near record profits while their unemployment is going up, and millions of people are still losing their homes. And so people are starting to ask themselves in all corners of this society, in all corners of the economy, what is the fundamental purpose of housing in this society? What's the fundamental meaning of housing? At what point should people who have nowhere else to go be kicked out of homes while there are vacant homes all around in different communities? And this question really has to be resolved by this society as part of the social clash. These questions raised by people suffering because of the faulty land relationships is creating an unprecedented opportunity for the social justice movement to present our vision for what the future could be, our vision for what this new society could be, and then give us meaningful opening to engage in struggle to move towards that new vision of what the society could be organized like. So for those people who have been waiting for the next social clash, for the big civil rights movement era to happen so that they can get engaged in that kind of activity and that kind of movement to advance the society and to change the society, I believe we're on the verge of that happening right now. Frantz Fanon, the great African philosopher, in his book Wretched of the Earth, said that every generation, through relative obscurity, must discover its mission, and then it must either fulfill that mission or betray it. Due to this economic crisis and the response to the crisis, we believe that the mission of the social justice movement, the mission indeed of this generation, in our lifetime, is to elevate housing to the level of a human right. The fundamental mission of this generation is to elevate housing to the level of a human right. And we have the opportunity to do that right now in a way that we have not had the opportunity to do that in any of our lifetimes. And we must organize ourselves in order to do that and move towards that objective. And I think that can happen, again, because of the crisis and because of the extent to which people are questioning those very things around land and around housing. With that said, while we have this opportunity, it is not by any means a foregone conclusion that at the end of this process, at the end of the clash, it's going to result in improvement in the lives of people. In fact, it could get tremendously worse. Or the instead of getting making advances, which would benefit the majority of people, we could squander those advances by accepting meaningless reforms. And that's going to happen when we have confusion around what is possible for us to achieve or what we should fundamentally be achieving. So we have to develop clarity around the issues that are at stake and the future that we have at stake here, the potential that we have for now. Now, part of that of recognizing the opportunity that we have, part of making that clarity is distinguishing between a root issue or a root problem and a surface issue or a surface problem. A root issue, of course, is something at the core of a problem, and the surface issue is not the problem itself, but is the manifestation of the problem. So, for example, if you are going to a fancy dinner party, and you're all dressed up, and your friends are all dressed up, and there's nice food at the fancy dinner party, and you walk in the door, and you realize that you have a runny nose, then you would have to get a napkin so you can start dabbing your nose so you're not dripping all over yourself and all over the food and all over your friends. So while you do that, while you're dabbing yourself, and you have to do that because you're dripping all over yourself at this fancy party, while you're doing that, and it's important to do that, you have to understand that what you're dealing with is not the problem. You're dealing with the manifestation of the problem. And if you're confused about the fact that you're not dealing with the problem itself, but with the manifestation of the problem, then you could theoretically spend the rest of your life dabbing at your nose. Because the real problem is not your runny nose. Your runny nose is the manifestation of the problem. The real problem is that you're sick, and at some point you have to deal with the fact that you're sick as a way of stopping the runny nose. In the same way, in the 1950s and in the 1960s, Black people were told that we could only live in this particular part of town. We couldn't go anywhere else. We had no say in what part we'd go in. We could live in this part, and that's the only part that we could live in. We were told that by the larger white society. And that was called segregation, or Jim Crow laws, which made up together created segregation. As a result of the Civil Rights Movement, we fought directly against those laws, those segregation laws, those Jim Crow laws, and ultimately we got them defeated. During this housing boom in the 2000s, we were told, the Black community, by the larger white community, the wealthier community, went to our community and said, that land that you're sitting on now is valuable, wasn't valuable before. We want you off the land so that we can make room for wealthier, whiter people to come in and we can redevelop this land. Objectively, there's no difference between someone telling you that you must live over here and someone telling you that you can't live over here and you have to get off of that land. Objectively, there's no difference. And the reason is that in the 1950s and 60s, the real problem was not segregation. And today, the real problem is not gentrification. In both instances, the real problem is land. And as long as we think the real problem is segregation and we can solve the problem just by changing a series of laws, or we think that the real problem is gentrification and we can solve the problem by putting in rent controls or some other means of dealing with gentrification, then we're never actually going to solve the problem. The real problem is that we have no more control over land today than we had control over our land in the 1950s and 60s. And large, that happens in the Black community, that happens in the Latino community, that happens in the Native American communities, and it even happens in many low-income white communities. The real problem here is not gentrification. The real problem is not segregation. The real problem is land. And just to be perfectly clear, right now, as people are suffering under this housing crisis, the real problem is not that you can't get a loan for no money down. The real problem is not that we have too high of interest rates. The real problem is not regulation or lack of regulation. The problem is that we have no control over the land upon which we sit, work, play, and worship. And until we change that, until we address that in a real way, we're going to be doomed to repeat these cycles of problems over and over again. We're going to repeat them, our children are going to repeat them, and our children's children are going to repeat them as well. In addition, if we don't recognize the difference between a root problem and a surface problem, it's going to be very easy for us to be fooled and tricked into making some tactical errors because we're going to think that we're solving the problem when we're actually not solving the problem. So when we build a movement and we say this is what we want, the system is not just going to hand it over. It's going to try to come back and negotiate and compromise and try to reform its way out of having to make some real fundamental changes. Kwame Nkrumah, the first president of the Free Ghana and the leader of the anti-colonialization movement in Africa, said that reform is a survival tactic of a system under attack. So when a system is under attack and shows sign of weakening, it's going to do, as a survival tactic, going to try to reform its way out of the attack. We can't let an unjust system get away with reform when we have the opportunity to change it fundamentally, to transform it fundamentally in a way that becomes more fair for a greater number of people.
Again, Max Ramon.
So we need to build a movement to elevate housing to the level of a human right, but that's going to require us to think very differently about some phenomenon that we have going on in this society. Some of the phenomena that we're going to have to rethink and transform our thoughts about, for example, is development. What's the meaning of development? What's the fundamental purpose of development? This society has been able to make incredible advancements in technology, in building. You have beautiful, big, tall buildings being built. You have internet connections. You have medical technologies that are being used now, which haven't been seen before in the history of mankind and are not even seen in many other countries that are supposed to be competing with this one. At the same time, however, this country has more people, more human beings, not buildings, more human beings in prison than any other country in this world, even those countries with 2, 3, and 4 times the population of this one. If development is fundamentally about buildings and high-speed internet and those kind of things and machines, then this society will go down as the greatest society in the history of humankind. If, however, development is fundamentally about human beings, about developing human beings, then this society will go down as one of the greatest failures because it was able to develop all kinds of things, build fabulous wealth for a very small number of people, while most people did not have access to basic education, basic health, and even basic housing in the midst of the greatest opulence in the history of this planet. We need to rethink the fundamental purpose of development. In the same way, we have to decide, this society must determine what the fundamental purpose of housing is. Most people think that the fundamental purpose of housing is to provide a home to human beings, to a family or to individuals. In this society, however, the real function, if we're honest with each other, the real function of housing is to serve as a profit center for banks, corporations, speculators, and others who want to live in a place and then fix it up and flip it or sell it after a few years. This society has to struggle with the real fundamental purpose of housing. I think the fundamental purpose of housing is at the core of this coming social clash that we have. At the core of these social clash that we have coming is the meaning of housing, the definition of housing, what the purpose of housing is in this society. I think in this social clash, in the same way we talked about having two competing ideas or multiple competing ideas about how to solve a problem, we have two competing rights that are running up against each other right now. On the one hand, we have the right of human beings to have housing, and on the other hand, we have the right of corporations to make a profit. And the two rights are increasingly mutually exclusive. If human beings are granted the right to housing, corporations will not be able to maximize their profit. And if corporations are allowed to maximize their profit, then human beings are not going to be able to have, who can't afford that, they can't afford to give corporations all the profit they want, are not going to be able to have housing. So this society, this generation, is going to be judged on how we resolve this fundamental clash, how we resolve this way of figuring out which one dominates over the other. And these social clashes are not anything new. A society has social clashes all the time. One person has the right to free speech. Another person has the right to peace and quiet. Those societies have to figure out how it prioritizes those two competing rights. At Take Back the Land, we assert that the right of human beings to housing supersedes the right of corporations to make a profit. And if we have to choose between a human being having a place to live and a corporation that just got billions of dollars of our tax money to bail them out and their right to hold a house vacant, we fall on the right of the human beings to have housing over and above, and even at the expense of the right of corporations to make a profit. We think that human beings are... In this society, human beings must be more important than corporations. So we need to not only think about that in abstract terms, but we need to be able to put that in effect on the ground. In October of 2006, a small group of us arrived on a vacant piece of land in the Liberty City section of Miami. We seized control over that land, the government-owned land, and we built a full-blown shantytown, which became known as the Emoja Village Shantytown. We housed 150 people or so. about 50 at a time. And the people who lived on that land were people who were not being taken care of by the government, who was getting our tax money. One of the things they were getting our tax money for was to take care of them. But those people who lived on the land had the power, while they were on the Umoja village, to make decisions about their own society. They met every week, and they were able to become self-determinant in the sense that every week they got together and they made decisions, they made rules and laws about how the society was run, how the small village was run. They decided who moved out, who moved in, how many shelters to build, what time the kitchen should be open, what time the kitchen should be closed. And people were able to make real decisions about how their lives were run. And I think, having been to the meetings at Umoja Village and having been to meetings at the City of Miami Commission and Miami-Dade County Commission, that the people of Umoja Village made better decisions about how to run their society than the people of City of Miami and Miami-Dade County did about how to run theirs.
Max Rameau starts out talking in this excerpt from a video about Umoja Village. The full video is located at rpg.com.
The Pottinger Settlement. There was in the early 1990s, the City of Miami would routinely arrest large numbers of homeless people and throw out their belongings and arrest them and charge them with all kinds of minor offenses. The ACLU of Miami sued the City of Miami. The City of Miami settled. What they said was that they conceded that being homeless is not a crime. Therefore, anyone who is homeless in the City of Miami, when there are no other alternatives, I mean there's no beds available, any of the shelters, any of the homeless shelters, so they legitimately have nowhere else to go, and they are on public land, anyone who meets those criteria can engage in what they call life-sustaining conduct without fear of arrest.
You cannot treat people as though being poor is a crime.
So therefore, that's the whole point of what they were calling a protest, which is now somewhere where we live.
We built our own little huts. We built our own little shanty. And we have our nursing come out here. We have our, you know, daily, weekly people come out here for jobs and everything. It's just like our own little town, our own little city.
The only people that, when I've been in the street, that have helped me has been the blacks. And the ones that have stepped me over has been the white. Because they think that they could buy me with the money.
Well, it's pretty good. I feel more safe here than on the street, you know, on the bridges and doorways.
Yes, I've been shot 3 times in the head. Right here.
He pulls a knife on me. This is inside the shelter.
See, I don't want to fight no more.
I've heard a few months ago, a couple of homeless people got beat up and one got killed, you know, sleeping in doorways. You know, so this place here, you know, I feel safe.
Change of climate and topic now to South Florida.
3 homeless men attacked by teenagers. One was killed.
Police in Fort Lauderdale, Florida are looking for a group of young men who brutally attacked several homeless people.
Just 2 weeks before Christmas, the City of Miami drafted an emergency ordinance which would effectively nullify the Pottinger Settlement. Though the city denies it, many in the community view it as a direct attack on Umoja Village.
Good evening, my name is Bernadette Armand. I'm here on behalf of the Umoja Village legal support team. Our team of lawyers have been poised, prepared to defend Umoja Village from the attacks coming from the City of Miami.
EM1.
EM1.
Wait a minute.
That's the emergency ordinance.
Yeah. An emergency ordinance being brought to you by your city attorney. A provision that deals with exempt property and still allows people to, if they pull a permit, to still demonstrate, but certainly does not allow them to establish living, habitable quarters on those premises.
The City of Miami was in the middle of hearing a item on the shantytown, which could potentially shut it down.
This doesn't deal with the homeless. This is not any reference to the Pottinger case.
Well, we have been hearing grumblings around that the city was planning on raiding us and was laying the groundwork to do so.
I don't see the necessity of the emergency. By creating this under emergency, you're shining the light on certain issue that was mentioned, but the city manager said that's not the reason, quote unquote, and that's my problem. You're creating it under emergency for a specific purpose that's gonna come back and bite all of us as a taxpayer. I don't see the need for the emergency. I think that this can be passed on a regular course of business, and then we're not opening ourselves for the challenge from a specific incident that's going on that nobody wants to mention, but we all know about it. So I really would like for this to pass as a regular ordinance with the proper public meetings. I don't see the emergency unless somebody wants to move somebody out of someplace before Christmas. Thank you.
The ordinance proposed by the city also has dire First Amendment implications that affect all of the city residents, and that it attempts to limit the ability of all people to move about public space such as City Hall, hospitals, and of course, public land freely.
Something called the Boston Tea Party and the Boston Massacre. And it was established that those people didn't have a permit either. And I wonder if the chief of police is going to issue permits for things that maybe go against the city.
So to show you how ridiculous it was, whenever the system has a law that's not working for them, it's actually working for the people, they do the first thing they can to change the law.
God sees what you do to people. And you're going to be judged for that.
From me graduating from Umoja Village, I believe this is a good jump off. Because if I can build a shanty and I can build a garden, I can build me a house and a home.
God bless you.
The audio we just heard about Umoja Village was from a video directed by Mark Cody in 2007. You can watch the full video at rpg.com.
After 6 months, when we announced that we were going to build more permanent structures on that land, when we announced that we were going to take over additional properties in the same area, and we announced that we were going to start to take over homes in the area, and we're going to start doing so 3 days after our six-month anniversary, on that day, the entire village fell to a suspicious fire. But the ideas which were in place, the things that motivated us to take over vacant land in October 2006, continued to motivate us after the fire, and the crisis which made what we did a requirement continued to persist after that.
You are listening to Circle A Radio here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
You're listening to a speech by Max Rameau of Take Back the Land. This speech was recorded on November 13th at Portland State University.
So in October 2007, we began the process of identifying vacant government-owned and foreclosed homes. We opened those homes up and we moved homeless people into peopleless homes without asking permission from either the banks or the government. We, just so it's clear, our primary concern is not with what is legal or illegal, because as we know, there would have been a time when it would have been illegal for us to do a lot of things. Our primary concern is moral and immoral. And if, the same way you can get a group of people to decide that something which is good and right is suddenly illegal, we can get those laws changed just as easily. Well, not as easily, but we can get those laws changed in the same way. And we continue our process of building a movement of liberating housing even today in Miami, Florida. However, you cannot build, you cannot engage in a social clash by having a small number of volunteers in one remote corner of a society take over a relatively small number of homes. It can only happen when the entire society is engaged in a struggle, is engaged in building a vision, is engaged in building a new kind of future. In October of 2009, a group called the U.S. Human Rights Network, which is a network of 300 organizations nationwide who engage in social justice through the human rights concept, the human rights notion, made a national call for a movement to take back land as a means of elevating housing to the level of a human right. We have many organizations who have signed on and many more who are waiting to get signed on, and we are building a national movement to take over land and to directly implement public policy ourselves in a way that the government is either unable or unwilling to do. We have an obligation to each other as human beings. There is an idea that there was a social contract built among human beings that said we have a whole series of things that we want to get done. We want to build roads and we want to build schools and we want to house people who don't have homes. And the way we were supposed to fulfill that obligation was to have this third entity, that was called government that we give our money to, and then that third entity would then build roads and build schools and house those who didn't have any homes. Now, and that was the way that we fulfilled our obligation towards each other. We gave money there, and that entity then took care of this responsibility. But when that entity is no longer doing what it's supposed to do, it does not diminish the responsibility that we have towards each other. In fact, just the opposite, it enhances the responsibility that we have to each other. So if and when the government is unwilling or unable to fulfill its responsibility towards those who are least fortunate among us, then we have the obligation to step back up and do it directly ourselves. And we're building a national movement to do it ourselves, since we can no longer rely on the government to do that. We're building a movement which is based on several principles. The operating principles are: housing is a human right. There should be local community control over land and housing, not just housing, but over land and housing. That means the communities make decisions about what happens in lands in their community. Leadership must be provided by those impacted communities, particularly low-income black women. The low-income black women who are most adversely impacted by the crisis must then lead the solution to the crisis. And they must be allowed in leadership, and we must follow their leadership. And that ultimately, the way we solve this problem is not by asking or begging governments who are seemingly unwilling to do things, but by taking direct action and doing things ourselves. We have a unique opportunity to fundamentally transform this society into something that's bigger and greater and can accomplish much greater things for the human beings who are in it. And we, all of you, all of us, must join that movement to transform the society. All of us must join the advancement of history. We must join the advancement of humanity. We all have an obligation to do so to each other. We all have an obligation to do so to history. We have an obligation to those who came before us and created this space for us to do this now. We're building a movement to liberate land and housing, and we all must become a part of that movement. Join the movement for land and liberation by joining our call. We have here sign-in sheets where you can come and you can sign up to endorse and join the U.S. Human Rights Network movement to liberate land and housing. And this will culminate, the movement will culminate, at least the first phase of it, in May 2010, where we're asking organizations all around the country during that month to liberate housing, to liberate vacant land, and to defend the people who are in housing who are about to get evicted, as a way of directly implementing public policy ourselves that elevates housing to the level of a human right, that elevates the rights of human beings above the rights of corporations. The U.S. Human Rights Network will be coordinating this activity. We'll not be controlling it, but with organizations throughout the United States. The U.S. Human Rights Network is not creating new organizations, but is providing support for those organizations to exist, for those organizations to do the work that needs to be done in order to advance history. So we have a movement that is building up, we have a movement that is advancing, and we must join that movement to liberate land, liberate housing, and ultimately to liberate people forward.
According to a federal report from the Housing and Urban Development Agency, Oregon ranks number one for homelessness per capita. The report cites a 35% increase in homelessness since last year, with 17,000 Oregonians now experiencing homelessness. On Thursday, November 12th, homeless community members and advocates once again addressed the City Council. Circle A Radio spoke with several people as they left the council chambers. Ibrahim Mubarak is one of the founders of Dignity Village and has been lobbying his elected officials to create legal options for people experiencing homelessness to sleep and stay dry. This is Ibrahim.
I'm here at City Hall today. I was on the agenda to speak about people sleeping out in the rain on the streets without being able to cover themselves with a tent or a makeshift shelter by using tarps or shopping carts or cardboard, whatever. The city commissioners and the mayor just don't understand about how people are not able, or let's call it disabled, to protect themselves from the elements because of a certain circumstance. They are homeless and they living in the streets. So numerous of time I come before the city council to try to reach their reprobated mind about how people sleeping in the streets are being soaked and wet and being shoved around like cattle. They say they come up with a solution they're called warming centers, where people can go out of the rain and get into the warming center. But when the homeless people stand in line, the police are running interviews and they targeting people and they going questioning people. And if you have a warrant or you did something or you're not allowed, they take you out that line and take you to jail. And then when you get out of jail, all of your valuables are gone, and so you're in the streets anyway. So what good are the warming centers? What I try to do is present a proposal to them that where they can allow people to gather on some land and put up tents or makeshift shelter, even at a price of $3 a day or $18 a week or $75 a month. They say they don't have the money, but this will generate money. What they're doing now is creating social segregation by doing for the people that have, and the people that don't have, they on their own to be used and imposing citation and giving them tickets and want them to pay that to oppress them. You know, that's an oxymoronic thing, you know, paying for a system or agreeing in a system that's going to oppress you, depress you, and repress you. So what I'm saying is that they keep pissing on our heads, telling us it's rain, saying they're helping us, and they really is hurting us.
Is that what you told the commissioners today?
Just what I told the commissioner, word for word. And I also told them that they're not seeing us, because each time we go make an appointment with them, they deter us to their third party and not their first party group. They don't see us per se. We voted for them. We didn't vote for their assistant to see us. We voted for them.
So a few months ago, we walked around and we talked to people living on the streets right after the sit-lie ordinance had been overturned, and I wondered if you could give an update. Are they enforcing things any differently than they were this summer?
They're enforcing things even more, because when it rains and we know people take shelter under the bridges and under structure to stay wet, we still not allowed to put tents up or makeshift shelter. So that's why they go under bridges and under vacant buildings that have a roof or an eave over where they can stay dry. They can have tarps, but they have to roll up in a tarp and sleep on the ground like a burrito. If it's still raining once it's past 7 o'clock, when homeless people are supposed to get off the street, they still have to get up in the rain, and their stuff still get wet, and they get wet, and they walk around wet, and they have to go to sleep the next day in a wet, cold bed. I mean, imagine going to sleep in a wet, cold bed every day on the cold, and then it started raining and raining. So what the police is doing, they sweeping everybody from under the bridges, hoping they'll go to these so-called safe warming shelters where you get in line. Even at the dining hall, police are going in the dining hall interviewing people or asking people questions. Who are you? Taking names down. And they don't have a right to do that. So this reminds me of 1936 Europe. What we proposing to them is, let us keep our structure up. Let us stay sleeping. Let us sleep in a warm, dry bed. Let us be in an area where we can be out of sight, if need be. Let us learn to take care of ourselves, self-sufficiency. What's wrong with that? I mean, are they afraid they're going to lose popularity by people learning how to take care of themselves and say, whoa, we don't have to pay $800 for a single room only rent. I mean, we can go out there and live in a tent. What a city afraid of.
Dave Regan is a homeless advocate and writes for the blog dignityadvocate.wordpress.com.
This is a huge disaster that has slowly unfolded because of the economy over the last 2 years. The chronically homeless are not the bigger picture here anymore. It's newly homeless people, that the people who tend not to have the time or patience or the awareness of these city council meetings. They're not showing up and getting in these people's faces. These veterans here tend to have a chronic homelessness pattern. The newly homeless are families living in cars, families living in garages, families scurrying around in the streets in Gresham. They're underrepresented here. If they could come down and talk to these councilmen, then they would realize, wow, this is a disaster. On the subject of disaster, we have a public emergency here. It has slowly unfolded, and these people just aren't recognizing it. If 10,000 people or even 1,000 people were thrown out of their homes overnight by an earthquake, we'd have a disaster declared by the mayor. And heck, they declared a disaster when a single affluent neighborhood saw a home slide down a hillside last year. It frees up contracting. It makes for very quick response time by the city, and it brings in aid. Well, they are not doing it because they just don't realize in the city council they're out of touch with what a horrible disaster this is.
This is Mike O'Callaghan.
Okay. What my experience at City Hall is that this is a higher social structure than most of us are used to. And it isn't empathetic with those in the lower social structure, you know, and that's the nature of things here. And really, they're pretty much powerless. You know, they don't know how to deal with the issue. They don't know how to deal with these things. People talk about homelessness. My issue is shelterlessness. And that was talked about here today. It's raining. People are getting wet. Okay, I have a picture of a poster child because I'm an advocate in this. I took about 2 weeks ago. She is totally soaked, 2:30 in the afternoon, totally soaked head to toe, pulling a wet sleeping bag. Okay, people shouldn't have to be without shelter. All that is needed for shelter is a tarp or a bridge. That's all. Okay, problem solved. They can't do this.
So why is the city dragging their feet on this?
In our minds, it's obvious there are things that can be done immediately, but you have to understand the nature of this bureaucracy that we're dealing with. Really, in order for them to do much of anything, they have to put out a request for a proposal, and before they put that out, they have to design the proposal and the ideas and put it out to nonprofit organizations that are certified, capable of bidding on this project, and then implement the bid, and then monitor the bid, make sure all the rules are followed. That's how this works. They can't just let people put up a tarp. That's anarchy. That's chaos. We have no control. You know, so you're talking the antithesis of what this government does. So it's difficult to communicate, first of all, the social structure, and secondly, you know, the fundamentalists of it. It was interesting for me going homeless voluntarily. Okay. It is extremely disconcerting to your body, and it was interesting to me to self-observe. Why? Because I spend virtually all my time in a house. I wake up in a house, I eat in a house, I sleep in a house, I watch TV, do whatever, write in the house. I go out and do stuff, yeah, but hey, basically all my life is spent in the house. Here you are without a house. It's like, wow, your body says, this is weird. Get me in a house, dude. I want to be in a house, you know? But I have resources, I have capabilities, I'm voluntarily homeless, and I have some income, you know, and another solution right out front here, you can look at it, is called the White Knight. I had a silver bullet before that. That one costs less than $100 to build, and it takes 4 hours of labor to build it, and somebody has something that they can live in that is warm, dry, and secure for under $100.
Can you describe for people listening what the White Knight actually is?
People always allude to it being a coffin, okay? You can see it out in front of City Hall. It's been out here for about a month, month and a half now. But basically, it's 2 foot by 2 foot by 6 foot, and it's on wheels, and it's insulated. So when you get inside it, your body heat warms it up, and it's portable, and it's legal. You know, so if people wanted to do something, you know, they could donate money or labor to this project and see where it goes. I have people that want to help me with this, and so I think I'm going to just start producing them and putting them out on the streets because these people, unfortunately, are incapable of doing anything. You know, humans are capable of responding. Bureaucracies are inherently immobile, you know, but they do a good job of spending money.
Janelle is a 31-year-old college student who has experienced homelessness on and off. Currently, she's housed and working on her second bachelor's degree at Portland State University.
I'm very disappointed. The city council here say that they're doing the best they can do, and they're putting 30% more funding in within the next 5 years. Okay, their 10-year plan. There's a group of people that have a 10-minute plan, and that's what we need here. We need a 10-minute plan, and we need more borders open to address the immediate emergency needs here in Portland, Oregon, so that people don't have to die like last year. You know, deaths should not occur from a basic need such as lack of shelter.
Again, Dave Regan.
There are a lot of misconceptions being perpetuated by the Oregonian and other mainstream media that like to focus on those who are voluntarily homeless, so to speak, or people who are mentally ill or road warriors. That's their latest mantra for get them out of here, you know. The fact is the great majority of the homeless out there are involuntarily homeless. They're suffering, they're cold, they're out of options, clearly. And they're not really just, they're in here shuffling around millions of dollars with the Portland Development Commission as we speak. And they just, when all these people today were asking for the right to camp just to be able to stay dry, their response was to, you know, at the end when they knew we couldn't say anything back, Mr. Mayor said, we've already spent $30 million and we're spending. These people aren't asking for money, they're asking for rights. And this is a human rights issue.
Community advocates are joining together to find a common solution to the ongoing criminalization and human rights abuses, and to push for better opportunities for people experiencing homelessness. If you have time, talents, resources, or ideas to contribute, you can send an email to i_tpop@hotmail.com. That's i_tpop@hotmail.com. Next up, you'll hear a piece by spoken word artist Walita Imarisha, which she wrote after reading Max Rameau's book, Take Back the Land, Land, Gentrification, and the Umoja Village Shantytown.
After reading Max's book, which was specifically about the shantytown called the Umoja Village that Take Back the Land started in 2006, they took over city-owned land. They built a shanty town that housed 150 people over a six-month period, basically liberated land where people ran their own lives and were able to, you know, find dignity and build community. And it actually burned in a mysterious fire after 6 months. So just reading the book, this is what bubbled up. The melted plastic face of a doll and a dream. Charred edges of tattered novels and hope. The taste of burnt wood and freedom in our mouths, dry as cotton bowls. Stoplight. Police faces flashing red, crying babies' fists pummeling nothing, not even air. The destruction of a home, the shredding of a soul. But we will rebuild. The sun flashes through the skin of our backs as window shades. Our bones packed with straw, clay, mortar serve as insulation. Our blood waters wildflowers, unsanctioned beauty that disrupt the continuity of concrete. This land knows us. Breath tangled in tree branches, tongue planted in soil. This land wants to come home to us. Cotton fields, northern factory floors, ancestors' eyes, project windows. Somewhere, a black girl plants a seed, cupped hands unfurling dirt across the span of her cheeks. This land will take us back.
That was Walita Imarisha, poet and professor of Black Studies at Portland State University. Thanks to Walita for her poetry and for organizing speaking engagements for Max Rameau on his Northwest tour. You can also hear from Walita, along with Taria Autry, every second and fourth Friday from 8 till 9 a.m. on KBOO on Good Sister, Bad Sister, Talkin' Mess. You've been listening to Circle A Radio on KBOO 90.7 in Portland. Thanks to Max Rameau of Take Back the Land for the inspiring and informative presentation. You can hear tonight's show, as well as the Q&A from Max Rameau's November 13th talk on KBOO.FM/CircleA Radio. We love hearing from you. Email us at CircleA Radio@gmail.com. And join us again on Wednesday, December 2nd, when we'll talk to members of the Grassroots Global Justice Alliance about the last 10 years of radical organizing in the U.S. and globally. Thanks for listening.